Hello. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm that one person that's standing between this thing and the break. So it's also worth it to pay maybe attention for another 10, 15 minutes as I'm the second responder to what we've just listened to. I'm very happy to be talking about Sadan a little bit and also delving into a little bit what Lars Splunk got us into. But the first thing that I wanted to say is that, you know, let's not forget, and it shouldn't come as an art historical afterthought, that the ready-made is also a lot of fun, and it's very obscene, and all the different things that evolve around the ready-made, I tried to pin down when we had many talks going on 4 years ago, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the ready-made. There was actually Olaf Nikolai and me talking about the ready-made, talking about the ready-made at the Boros collection, and I tried to pin down all the different things that go around it, you know, the non-Euclidean geometry, fourth dimensions, gray matter, anything that has not to do with the retinal only, with what meets the eye, you know, that rendezvous, that private experience, and all of these things that evolve around it. The ready-made after the ready-made is what we're talking about. Now, Christian and Karin wanted this for their collection. So what I'm saying is even art historical notes are now being considered artworks as long as they're dealing with the ready-made. But the one thing that I wanted to really get into quickly is there's an overlooked ready-made that has not actually entered scholarship yet, and I found it so interesting, and I wanted to bring that up. It's not a discovery of my own, but it has to do with Sadan a lot, and I thought that maybe Sadan doesn't even know about this. Of course, he certainly does with all the research he's done, but maybe there's a slight chance that he doesn't. And so let me just, in the year 2000, the selected correspondence of Marcel Duchamp was published by Hector Obalk and Francis Naumann for Thames and Hudson. There's a letter in there from early 1919 that Duchamp wrote to one of the Stettheimer sisters. He met the Stettheimer sisters. He came to New York after the Armory Show, 1914, 1915, and he met the Stettheimer sisters, wealthy daughters of a German immigrant, that all fell in love with him madly. He gave them French lessons or whatever, but they were very happy with Marcel Duchamp. And he actually, you know, there's Carrie Stettheimer, who built a little dollhouse all her life. Duchamp painted a little nude descending a staircase for her, which can still be seen in that dollhouse in the Museum of the City of New York in Manhattan. There was Florine Stettheimer, famous artist now, that Duchamp gave an exhibition to even shortly after she passed away. And there was Etty Stettheimer, that Duchamp was probably most closest to of the sisters, because she was a writer. And Duchamp appears in some of her novels as a character. And actually, he wrote that letter to her, that's part of a letter to her. He writes to all the three sisters. He wrote that part of the letter to Etty, and He from Buenos Aires. He had fled New York because he had fled the war, and now he had fled New York to Buenos Aires because the war was still going on, and even as a Frenchman, he wasn't safe from the draft. So there was another reason for this 32-year-old to just leave and leave for another country. And so he went to Buenos Aires. He had asked her three times. He asked Eddie, "Are you going to come to New York? Are you going to come to Buenos Aires with me?" And he didn't. So she didn't. But he was there, and then he writes her a letter. And he talks about the ready-made, actually, and that is what I find tremendously interesting. And it is being seen, you know, it is being recognized here. You can see by the footnote that, you know, there was some research going into this, what he is referring to in that letter. What is interesting, though, is that Hector Obalgas, as co-editor of this book that appeared in 2000, of this book, he also wrote an article that was published in Touffet, the Marcel Duchamp Studies online journal, talking about the ready-mades and the progression of ready-mades. What I think is very interesting, especially today and with this conference, and I think that's where Dieter Daniels, that I have to thank for putting this together, and Lars Splunk's research is so amazing, that both of them really look at this, you know, they're chronicling the ready-made. You know, the way we look at the ready-mades now from 100 years ago is very different, because we see them as looking back 100 years. But they looked, and Dieter Daniels in 1992, Duchamp and die anderen was really doing that. What was known about the ready-made in 1915? What was known about when the first time that Duchamp really came up with that term ready-made? What was known about all of that? So looking at it from this chronicling perspective, what is interesting is that Duchamp, for those of you who can't read French, I just wanted to translate that real quickly, is that he writes to her, "Have you heard about ready-mades? If not, ask Rocher, André-Pierre Rocher, a close friend of Marcel Duchamp's, about them. That very funny article in the Tribune that you mentioned is a ready-made. I signed it, but I did not write it. Je l'ai signé, mais pas écrit. That's what he writes in that letter. And Hector Olberg, although he writes that book about the ready-mades, he doesn't bring up this article as a ready-made. How do we know that a certain article is that we're talking about, the nude descending a staircase, man surveys us, is written by Henri McBride? Because Duchamp goes on and writes about the cheveux ondulés, which he no longer had or which he only had as a child. And we know that from this article here, which is the article that is being referred to in this book, which Duchamp calls a ready-made, this article itself, the Henry McBride, an art critic, writes somewhere in the text, it might be too small for you to read, he's only 28, because that article appeared 4 years earlier, dresses most correctly in the mode, describing Marcel Duchamp, and is quite handsome, as Duchamp really was, with blonde, curly hair. So we know about the cheveux ondulés because this is the article that refers to his blonde, curly hair, which he said he never had, only as a kid. So what is interesting is that Duchamp says this article is a ready-made because it is signed a ready-made. And Dieter Dalitz was referring to that earlier letter that Duchamp wrote to Suzanne, his sister, when he was in New York, and he asked her to sign an object as a ready-made, in this case, the bottle dryer. Detail of how to sign a bottle dryer that was left in his studio. He says, sign it d'après Marcel Duchamp. And this is basically without his own handwriting. And this is what he tells Etty Stettheimer. Je l'ai signé, mais pas écrit. I signed it, but I didn't write it. And Duchamp, as we already heard from Lars Prunk, he never really signed his art, his work at the time, because he wanted to get away from the hand and from the artistic hand and all that what artists can do. And he was a great painter. But he actually, his paintings, shortly before he stopped painting, he signed, but not in terms of a signature, but in terms of typeface. Sometimes really large letters, typeface, to remove himself as an artist. So this would be a ready-made because it is signed by Marcel Duchamp. What follows is, of course, quotes from an interview that Henry McBride did about Marcel Duchamp. So that's why it says by Marcel Duchamp. But this thing, and I thought it was so interesting to what Zadane is doing with the Fountain Archive, is that he's looking at reproductions of ready-mades, of Fountain in particular. And that is the other thing that I wanted to get into while I'm speaking to you about the ready-made. You've seen the Fountain. Let me see what's the name. Oh, this one I'm just probably going to skip, although it's very interesting. Maybe if you ask about me, I'll show you. I leave that there as something that we don't know what this actually is. But I'm not going to take you there, although I could. But the one thing is, the ready-made after the ready-made, what is interesting is that, okay, maybe I do it real quick. The thing is this, it's really quick. You see Duchamp sitting here in a deck chair, right? This is a deck chair, as you know, from ocean liners. Duchamp came in an ocean liner. Duchamp went back and forth, Paris and New York, in an ocean liner. This is a typical deck chair. And there's actually a note in the deck chair that we know from the white box that was published, A l'Infinitif, in 1966. That is actually not my research, but research done by Rhonda Roland Shearer. There's this postcard in the white box note, where nobody actually knows where that postcard comes from. These are facsimile edition of Marcel Duchamp's notes that he published 2 years prior to his death. He published many boxes, but this one he published 2 years prior to his death. When Serge Stauffer, who we'll have a whole symposium about in 2 weeks in Stuttgart, asked Tini Duchamp, his wife, Duchamp had passed away in 1968, what is that actually? What does that show? Aquarelle, what is it in English? The watercolor thing. What is that? And Tini Duchamp thought that this could very well be by Marcel Duchamp. And if you turn around what it says on the back by 90 degrees, actually the way that the fountain is also turned around when we see it on a pedestal and displayed as it is now, Duchamp talks about, in this note, about two similar objects of different dimensions, but one being the replica of the other, like two deck chairs, as we have seen Marcel Duchamp sitting in one, one large and one doll size, could be used to establish four-dimensional perspective. What is interesting is that Rhonda Rowland Shearer, if you turn the postcard also by 90 degrees, this could very well be, you know, a deck chair, the outline of a deck chair in an ocean liner, pretty much like the one that Duchamp was sitting in. That could be a stretch, but it is interesting when you see what all the research of Duchamp is about. Now, what I want to get into is you guys, because, you know, the one thing that is always talked about in Duchamp research is that, you know, what Duchamp himself said, it's the spectator that makes the artwork. You know, it's you. It's, you know, the spectator as contributor. When you talk about what museums are trying to do right now, it's also DIY, do it yourself, you know, bringing the spectator, do something hands-on, have him contribute to what it is that we see. So the one thing is that I try to do that really with the fountain, the way that Zadan is collecting all that massive archive in terms of the fountain. It is also interesting to be celebrating, or was interesting to celebrate, the 100th anniversary of the fountain. And just one word about the fountain. You know, you saw many, many pictures of it. It says Armat on it, right? And Duchamp was all into puns. And this is known in Duchamp research. I just wanted to throw that at you as well. Armat is such an innocent signature, but Duchamp actually invented graffiti as art at that moment in time, because it was just painting a different person's name on graffiti. And you know, for those guys that go into bathrooms, especially if you're in the university, there is a lot of graffiti still in bathrooms. So Duchamp writes Armat. What does Armat actually mean? We know that R stands for Richard. Richard Mutt could also mean rich art is mud, M-U-D, and not M-U-T-T, because Duchamp was always going up against art that was very expensive, you know, art that was only there as a commodity for sale. So that name in itself could signify, you know, a sort of criticism. He himself said that the fountain was made by Mott Ironworks, so this Mutt is a reference to the actual producer of this fountain. There's also a comic strip that was called Jeff and Mutt, so he was referring, Duchamp himself was referring to that cartoon. But knowing that Duchamp was also could also speak German and was playing chess a lot, we know that Mutt means mate. You know, there could also be, in terms of the German, Mutt, or read in English as mat, could also be Schachmat or checkmate. So bringing in, you know, what he's doing with chess. If you read it the other way around, it's not Armat, but Mat R, which could also be the German Mutter. And as you know, I mean, this goes very, very far. But then you could look at the fountain as a womb. And Duchamp in 1913 published a note saying, as a female, one only has the public urinal and one lives by it. You know, whatever that means, what I'm trying to say here is that any little thing that you open up with Marcel Duchamp is just, you know, and 100 years of research is just a lot of stuff. So how do you celebrate 100 years of Marcel Duchamp's fountain and you return it to the spectator instead of this little art historical circle where we come up with these funny puns that I'm boring you with, is that we thought, or I thought rather, let's do this hashtag 100, let's try the fountain, hashtag, what is it? Hashtag Fountain 100. It's still alive. You know, people post still on that. On the hundreds of posts. And I approached all the major museums that have works by Marcel Duchamp in their collection. So the MoMA, the Philadelphia Museum, the Centre Pompidou. Of course, the Haus der Kultur in der Welt was involved, as well as the Staatsgalerie Stuttgart, who is having that great Stauffer Duchamp symposium in 2 weeks' time. So there were actually about 20 museums around the world that I said, look, April 9th is the day that the show where Marcel Duchamp was supposed to show under a pseudonym, his Fountain 100, April 9th, 1917, in New York, was the day that the show was supposed to open, and that happened to be a Sunday this year. So let's turn April 9th, 2017, into the anniversary of the 100-year celebration of Duchamp's fountain. And even if you don't have the urinal or a replica of the urinal in your collection, there's men's room in every museum, right? So let's just use the men's room for, you know, an impromptu homage, for talks that can be going on where people just bring the text or talk about Duchamp and or sign the fountain Armat. And this is what actually happened. I was so happy that many of these museums actually said, yes, we're going to participate. Because I said, it doesn't cost any money. All you have to do is open your restroom, turn it into a unisex restroom, and have all these impromptu homages going on and deal with Marcel Duchamp. You know, and do this online, do this via the hashtag. And, you know, the Tate opened their doors, and they got, you know, 20,000 views right away. And the world press picked up on that. And it became that funny story of... Thank you. I'm the one who is doing a very interesting talk, and just give me 2 more minutes. No, Lars, you have to do what you have to do, but you could have told others as well. I'm done. The thing is this, because we have been running out of time 25 minutes before I even got on the stage. Thank you. So the thing is this, the one thing, I'm just going to show you pics. So we had all these international museums contributing, and the good thing was that it became a real interactive thing. This was just posted right now under Fountain 100, and it's a woman saying, look, this is what you could wear for Halloween. And it also became a good story because MoMA, you know, the chief curator there, Klaus Biesenbach, he told me, yes, we're going to open up our doors. And then it was free entry for everybody who said on April 9th, my name is Richard Mutt. They would be let in for free. But then MoMA, when Artsy and all these people that covered this, or ArtNet, asked MoMA, MoMA said, we don't know about this idea. So it became this meta level of a story where this could just be a prank and not really happening. And MoMA was going back and forth of whether they should allow visitors for free or not. So this is all of this was happening. The Städel opened their doors, Haus der Kultur in der Welt opened their doors, Staatsgalerie opened their urinals. All I wanted to say is with Marcel Duchamp is really you know, it's what was iconoclastic before in terms of these gestures of really opening up the door for iconoclasm and something that's going up against, you know, the canon of the arts. Has now, of course, returned full force as an icon when we look at the ready-mades nowadays. What was an iconoclastic gesture is now an icon in the middle of what we think about the arts, and that's where I think also art history has changed because of the ready-made. And thus, I would also like to argue that art historical writing needs to change. You know, we need to put more feelings, enthusiasm, and exclamation marks in our, you know, trying to win over people and make them understand that Duchamp still matters. Thank you very much, and sorry for being a little over time.